General Downward, Reel 3. I think you were telling me about the pilot who crash-landed.
Oh, yes. The aircraft was a gunner flight, an Australian pilot, and he'd been hit with a .5 machine gun. The aircraft had been hit in the, sort of the tail section, and this is what we ascertained later by being able to examine the wreckage, which had crashed on our side of the line. And what had happened, apparently, was that the one bullet had severed the rudder cable, and Captain Liston, his name was, managed to get the aircraft back to our side, and he actually told us that the aircraft was out of control, but he wasn't too sure what it was. He knew that he couldn't maintain direction. He got it right back as far as our own strip, tried to carry out a landing. The aircraft, as the nose came up, then suddenly sort of veered to starboard, and he opened power with the throttle, and this carried the aircraft even sort of more strongly across to the yawing across to the right, and he then went right across the strip without really touching it, right across the strip, and crashed into a rocky face on the other side of the engine and was killed instantly. It took us a little bit of time to get to, in fact several hours. We couldn't actually get across the engine at that point, which was fairly fast flowing, but we eventually had to get right round the other side and then climb down the rock face and get to him. But eventually we got the wreckage up and we were able to examine it, and we found that was what had happened. But the tragedy of it was, and this is where we suddenly had a sort of turn or change in our tactics and in our sort of preparation, none of our pilots at that time flew with parachutes. And this, of course, had been the sort of the technique which had been used by the AeroP during the last war in 39-45. And it was visualized that the Auster and the AeroP type role, because it was perhaps never getting much above 1,000 feet, perhaps most of the time operating below that height, the pilot would never have a chance to operate a parachute. And they're fairly bulky, and it added weight to it in addition to all the other clobber which might be in the aircraft, such as the radio and cameras and things like that. But from then onwards, we then said, right, this is obviously a very real risk to our pilots. Therefore, we will now equip our chaps with parachutes. So that was the turning point. From then onwards, everybody flew with parachutes. Very fortunate that the remedy was put into hand so quickly, because within another 10 days or so, we had another pilot shot down. He was able to parachute out and was taken prisoner and came back at the end of the war. And later we had a third case of a chap being shot down, which was really quite an interesting story, sort of slightly amusing in retrospect as to what happened. It was right at the very end of my time, and we had a new soldier, a new ground crew chap coming out to us, a chap who belonged to the Remi. And he had never flown in an aircraft before, and asked one of the pilots if he could fly with him in the back seat. So the sergeant, Sergeant Cameron, was due to do the dawn flight. So he said, yes, I'll take you up with me on the dawn flight. We'll be up there for about an hour and a half. Put on warm clothing and come with me. I'll brief you when we start off. Next morning, put him in the back of the aircraft, fitted him out with the parachute. This poor lad had never been in an aeroplane of any sort before. Off they went. They bored out into the darkness, flew up and down the front, and were suddenly duffed up with a whole battery of 37mm anti-aircraft guns, and the aircraft was hit. Sergeant Cameron said, right, we've got to bail out. The boy in the back didn't even know exactly what bailout meant, I think. Anyway, Cameron did manage to brief him as to exactly what to do and how to get out. But with the Auster and with the arrangement of the radio set, it's very difficult to make a clean exit from the back seat. So Cameron himself, the pilot, had to bail out first, which he did, and the craftsman, this young lad in the back, bailed out a few seconds later. Both the parachutes opened quite readily. There was no difficulty there. And both of them hit the ground inside the enemy line, unfortunately, having been carried there by the wind. Otherwise, I think they would have just about made our own line. But anyway, they fell into enemy hands. The Chinese picked them up eventually and realized who was the pilot, because he was in his flying suit with his wings up. And the chap in the back, who'd got binoculars around his neck and had fairly obviously been sitting in the back seat, they reckoned that he must be an officer. So in the interrogation, they treated him as being something very special right throughout, and they gave him quite a rough time, particularly as he appeared to be so obstinate in his questions. They couldn't get any sort of real answers from him at all. The first question which was asked of him was, what is the name of your commanding officer? He either didn't know or he was too panic-stricken to remember what it was, but he'd only been with the flight less than 24 hours, and it was quite understandable when he said he didn't know. What is the number of your unit, the formation, and the strength of the unit? He didn't know anything about that. And practically every question he was asked, he knew absolutely nothing about it whatever. I don't think he even knew the name of the pilot. And they thought this chap was really being sort of a hard case to crack. And they roughed him up a bit, and they gave him a very difficult time, mainly by sort of sticking him into solitary confinement. And eventually, having asked him several times, well, if you're not an officer, what do you do? What is your job? He said, I'm a vehicle mechanic. So they said, right, well, we'll test this. And they had an old motorcycle or some sort of motor vehicle of some sort and asked him to get it going. So the boy went out and asked for one or two tools and got the thing going. And that convinced him he wasn't an officer, that he really was a craftsman.
They seem to have been convinced that officers couldn't mend motorbikes.
This, I think, this was the Chinese line, yes. But he came back, both of them came back safely after the war, although the pilot did have a rougher time later and had came back suffering from a certain amount of vitamin deficiency, and I think his eyes were suffering for quite a time afterwards. But the craftsman seemed to have recovered quite quickly. They weren't in captivity for too long. It was only a matter of about 4 or 5 months, which was long enough, but in comparison to some of the British prisoners of war, that was really quite a short stint.
Did you have any briefings about what to do if you fell behind enemy lines and if you were captured?
The pilots did, yes. But it was a one-time-only affair, I seem to remember, when we first went out to Korea. And this, of course, had been sort of standard officer training for me and my second-in-command, both of us with wartime experience, as to how we should sort of react. And it was, of course, the old set procedure, number, rank and name and nothing else. But even by that stage, it was becoming fairly obvious that, in the light of experience of prisoners of war who came back from Germany and Japan, and also from other theatres, which chaps were able to give some sort of account of their sort of captivity, that just carrying out that sort of procedure wasn't really working, and it was very difficult to expect a prisoner of war just to sort of continue with that line. There were far more subtle ways of getting to the sort of getting into the chap himself and extracting information. And we were actually, the pilots were taught a form of coding, which we could, I'm not sure that whether this is still, I don't think it's classified now, but anyway, the sort of system of the coding as to how we would communicate if we were allowed to write letters back to our next of kin, how we would carry out a coding of the letters, that was taught to us fairly early during our time in Korea. This was carried out by RAF intelligence, by the way, and I can't remember exactly how the system worked now, but I know that all our next of kin were known to our own intelligence people, and if we'd been shot down, and in the case of Sergeant Cameron, I think that immediately the intelligence people would have got on to the next of kin back in England saying, right, if you receive a letter from your son or your husband who is in a prisoner of war cage, having been taken prisoner on such a date, would you please not destroy the letter or disclose it to anyone else? Please let us have the letter. This was the sort of the general understanding. But knowing one's captors and the sort of the techniques, looking back at it, I think we were all fairly naive at that time as to exactly what we might expect. With my regular experience over nearly 40 years and sort of seeing the various techniques which have been taught to officers and NCOs in more recent times, I think that we're far more, and soldiers are far better prepared for it now. They certainly were not well prepared for it during the time of Korea.
Did you carry a personal weapon while you were aloft?
Yes. I always carried a 9mm Browning pistol, and I think we all did. One or two occasionally used to carry a carbine, I think, which they'd acquired, or a Sten it was, I suppose, at that time, and one chap actually did have a carbine which he'd acquired from the Americans. But from the point of view of if you had to bail out, once we had parachutes, there was no question of carrying a weapon in your hands. The thing is that you had to rely on whatever weapon you got actually strapped to you, either on in your jacket or down the side of your leg, where I used to carry mine, rather American cowboy style, strapped in a holster, strapped to my thigh.
You mentioned the aircraft with the craftsman taking off before dawn, boring into the night, you said. Did you do much night flying?
No. We were not asked to, and I don't think we could have really given a great deal of help from the point of view of observation by night. There was little doubt that the last light brought out a tremendous amount of detail for us, particularly for the gunners, in being able to spot flashes. The counter-bombardment was a great time to go and fly, because the flash, obviously, either of a gun muzzle or a mortar barrel, would become very distinct, whereas in broad daylight you might not see it. So that was the opportune time to fly. But night flying, no. We didn't actually carry out any sort of night flying over the enemy line. Frequently we landed by dark, when it was too dark to observe anything else, and then we used to sort of have a flare path system, which were literally also sort of jam tins full of sand with some paraffin poured into them, and when the aircraft appeared more or less overhead, our own ground crew rushed out with a box of matches, lit these flares down the strip, and we would land by the flares, which we'd been taught to do back in Middle Wallop as part of our normal sort of training procedure anyway for that type of aircraft. But the night flying as such, we didn't carry out.
Did you come under any effective air traffic control system?
Only when we came down to the rear of the army area, when we came down to Seoul, and initially we were at some disadvantage here because we did not have VHF, in other words, straightforward aircraft-type radio communications. We had some battlefield tactical communications, the 62 set talking down to a 19 set or similar battlefield-type sets at headquarters. But coming back into the Kimpo area, which we were asked to do quite a lot, particularly in our early stages, taking staff officers back to Kimpo, which was, of course, the big airfield, the main airfield, possibly then en route back to Japan or en route back to Hong Kong, to get into the air traffic control system there, we used to have to more or less fly over the top of the air traffic control and indicate that we had no communication, and then we'd either wait for a green light or a green vary cartridge, and then we would sort of land as quickly as possible. I remember only too well one or two rather hair-raising experiences, having had the green light and then landing, suddenly to find myself, the moment I turned off the runway, a tremendous roar behind me, and a couple of Sabre jets had obviously been waiting to take off, would be roaring down the runway just behind me, and it was a rather hair-raising experience initially while we had no VHF. After about 6 months of being in the theatre and operating out of the large airfields, we did acquire a type of set, an English set, I think it was a Pi VHF, which was fitted to our aircraft. Not a great range, but sufficient anyway for us to be able to call up air traffic controls once we were in the range of about 4 or 5 miles of a main airfield, and then life became very much easier and much safer for us in approaching the large fields.
Were the 62 and 19 sets reliable?
Yes, on the whole they were, providing one didn't have to do too much in the way of frequency changing. You had a flick frequency, I mean you set two frequencies and merely work on one, and if you knew what you were likely to flick to, you would set that flick frequency on the ground and then sort of change over. That was easy enough, and then just retune the aerial. But what was difficult was if you then had to go to frequency, such a frequency, and then having to go through the whole of the tuning procedure. Very difficult if you were in the forward areas, particularly if you were likely to come under fire. And the only way then to do it was to get back onto the safe side of the line and do your tuning. So on the whole, we preferred to remain on frequency, perhaps occasionally flick to an alternative frequency, and that would usually happen with my pilots if we suddenly spotted a target, and as I mentioned earlier, there was no gunner AeroP airborne at that time. We would then be told to flick to such and such a frequency, which was the sort of prepared frequency, and we would then find ourselves talking direct to the sort of gunner regiment or the gunner battery concerned, and we would then give them the grid reference and direct them onto the target. But 62 set, for the range we were operating in along the Commonwealth front, which was fairly wide, actually, from the left to the right of the front, was pretty wide, but nevertheless, the 62 set did work very well at a height. But, of course, you were subject to screening. If you got down below hills or down below features, quite often it was difficult to make yourself heard back at control, and then it was a case of just lifting up until you got a direct line of sight with the main set, with the control set.
Did you make all your broadcasting clear?
Yes. Most of the conversation was in clear, although certain features were code-named. The trouble was that the code names became so much a part of everyday speech. I mean, for instance, the features which are still well known, of course, talking about the hook, talking about Little Gibraltar, which was Hill 355, talking about Matthew, Mark, Luke, I think they were three hills, which were 227, I seem to remember, but a bit to the west of 355. These were all sort of names which had been stuck on those features by the soldiers on the ground, and they were handed over regiment to regiment as they came in and went out. But there were certain things which we would codename if we were setting out on a special mission and we were asked to look at a certain area. We would probably give it a name on the spot before we took off, which was agreed either by control or with us or the controlling staff at divisional headquarters. We were going to look at codename Apple Pie or something like that, or sort of pumpkin Eater or something, whatever it might be, which was a one-time only. But otherwise, most of the conversation was in clear, and grid references, obviously if we were talking about enemy positions, we would normally talk in clear, but again, if we were examining one particular area, if we thought it was really sensitive and we hadn't got a code name for it, we would try and get that information back by a normal sort of codec system, which we did carry as a slide part of our sort of slide decks, to be able to sort of pass that back. But we were loath to carry codes, too many codes in the air, for obvious purposes, obvious reasons. If we came down, we were it was immediately compromised.
Roughly, what proportions of your time was spent in taxiing officers, reconnaissance, and AeroP activity?
Initially, I should say that when we first went out, I should say that nearly 70% of our time was taken up in carrying staff officers from the forward area, from our divisional headquarters strip, carrying them back to the rear area, mostly to Corps, which was at Wijambu, and quite often back to Kimpo, which was really sort of staff officers going back to Japan, either en route to Hong Kong or back to UK even. And eventually, as I got a feel for what was required and became more confident in the ability of my pilots to carry out a reconnaissance role, we then more or less reversed it, so that it became, towards the end, it was not quite 70%, but say 66% of our task then became reconnaissance, and the other third really was carried out as sort of taxiing of staff officers down to Corps and Army. But it was... It would have even sort of increased more from the point of view of the reconnaissance role, but the end of the war came and that was it. I did write it up, the type of role, I wrote it up for the what was then sort of the light aircraft school on the sort of the techniques which we'd evolved, but I dare say that the sort of the ideas of that type of reconnaissance which we were carrying out in 51, 52, 53, wouldn't or couldn't be applied now in some modern battle conditions. It's something which is now completely dead.
What was the workload like for the pilots?
It varied according to weather. Obviously, in the long daylight periods of the summer, aircraft were airborne practically all the time. There was always an aircraft on standby, and I think that most of our missions, reconnaissance missions, were usually about 2 hours, and we could stretch it to 2.5 hours. The gunners were frequently airborne for 2.5 hours on an AeroP shoot, and would come back literally about their last pint of petrol on some of the missions, getting terribly excited if they spotted a target which they really wanted to go for and really sort of to see it out and hang on to the very last minute. And then sort of give a warning that they might not make it, they might have to sort of glide in and sort of do a glide landing. But on most occasions, people In fact, everyone did make it back to our own strip unless they were shot at by enemy action. So during the daylight hours, in the summer months, my average flying hours during that time was about 110 to 115 hours a month in flying time. In the winter months, it was probably down to about 40 hours to 50 hours a month. And I remember one or two occasions, certainly in the early time when we were there, which was probably December 51 and January 52, those sort of winter months, short daylight periods, new flight having arrived, not having a reconnaissance role properly established at that time, our average flying hours were probably only about 35 a month. In other words, probably about 1.5 hours a day or something like that. But usually those 1.5 hours may be made up with two or three landings, because they were short takeoffs and landings going back to Corps or Army, which was back to Corps was only about a quarter of an hour's flight, back to Army was about a half hour's flight. So it wasn't terribly strenuous from the pilot's point of view in the initial stages.
So you didn't have any problems with fatigue or strain?
Only one case that I had that I remember, and that was due to really some battle conditions whilst flying. One of my NCO pilots was badly shot up on two or three occasions. The aircraft wasn't badly damaged, but the third occasion he was turned upside down by an anti-aircraft burst, I think from a 37mm. He went down out of control but recovered and brought the aircraft back, but that really shook him quite badly, and I then had to send him back on a few days' leave back to Japan, and he was pretty near towards the end, nearly at the end of his time anyway. He'd been an extremely good pilot. He'd carried out two very good forced landings in our rear areas on one occasion when he went to help somebody else, and on a second occasion when he actually had an engine failure taking off from Kimpo, shortly after Kimpo, and managed to put the aircraft down on the road. So he was a very proficient pilot and very steady, and he was very popular with passengers when he used to take them up and brief them and take them on a reconnaissance role. But anyway, through these sort of this sort of fairly sort of close sequence of three duffings up which he got from anti-aircraft, I felt it was time he had a rest. And as I say, he was nearly at the end of his time, so when he came back, I kept him on sort of communication role, in other words, just sort of flying back to rare areas, and then eventually went back to UK at the end of his time.
What about the workload of the ground crew on maintenance and repair? Was that heavy?
The role of the
ground crew.
Yes, the role of the ground crew. It was, I think it was fairly clear cut for the Royal Air Force chaps in that they lived and worked entirely on the strip itself, on our main strip, where the aircraft were based and where the pilots were based. And the aircraft were put out in dispersals. Initially, they were completely open to the elements and to any form of ground fire which might be sort of thrown at us. And then latterly, we then, with the help of the sappers, then built large bomb bays, if you like, or sort of dispersal bays, where we could push the aircraft back in. It was rather sort of horseshoe-shaped. At least it gave protection to the aircraft from three sides. And the ground crew were able to work in there safely, partly away from any form of ground fire, which we really had very little trouble from over the course of our 18 months. And certainly it also helped to act as a windbreak as well. Ground crew did have difficulties with the weather from the point of view of using their hands in sub-zero conditions. The temperature was going down to, I think, about minus 20 at night anyway, and it was extremely cold in one of those winters when the engine froze to a depth of about 7 or 8 feet, I mean, strong enough for tanks to drive across the engine, and we used to find that the aircraft used to freeze to the ground unless we stood them on bits of wood to keep them out of the mud. But this, of course, in the daylight hours, also had difficulties for the ground crew in being able to work on engines and work on the sort of parts of the aircraft. So we always had to have forms of heating around for them. Firstly, to blow onto their hands while they were working on the engines, and secondly, to heat the engines up and get them warm. And we had a very effective heater. I've forgotten the name of it now, but anyway, it was a hot air blower, a large hot air blower with a motor engine, which literally blew quite a strong flame into a flame trap, and you get a very strong duct of air, hot air, through about two or three trunks, which could then be sort of fitted into the aircraft or into the engine compartment of the aircraft, warm it up while the chap was working on it. But of course, it also became a great source of comfort to the ground crew, who would always be diving off down to sort of to one of the bays to stuff one of these hot air trunks underneath their parka jackets to get themselves warm and then sort of go and work. But that was just one of the sort of perks, I suppose, of working on the aircraft. So far as the army ground crew were concerned, one had to, I think we were a little, I was a little more concerned about their sort of welfare and their sort of morale from the point of view of keeping them occupied. I did occasionally have to run exercises to send them out with vehicles to sort of carry out some radio techniques and radio practice at different parts of the Commonwealth Division. Occasionally even used to send them up to the forward units so they would sort of see the forward units in action, not necessarily to take part in forward platoons. I couldn't afford to lose them, any of them, for any sort of length of time, but at least to be with the forward companies and see what the chaps on the ground were really putting up with. But their main job, really, was, as I say, driving the vehicles and working the radios, and while we were static, that particular task rather went into decline, and I had to keep them occupied by sending them out on these exercises. Map reading, of course, was another thing which I insisted on them doing, and also other lectures which we could do undercover or indoors, which I put used to have taught to all my chaps, and that was first aid. I suppose survival in the field to a certain extent as well, how to survive on sort of emergency rations, how to keep oneself warm, make up a basher if one was caught in the open. Those sort of things were just general survival sort of techniques. But one tried to carry on a certain amount of logical training applicable to the task itself and also applicable to soldiers, the soldiers' role in general.
How was your time spent? How much of it was flying and how much of it was admin and running the unit?
I suppose the admin side, I used to leave quite a lot of that to my second-in-command, another captain, who for most of the time he was there really was the VIP pilot, used to fly the divisional commander and any other sort of senior officers who were visiting us. He was an extremely efficient, very capable pilot. But I used to sort of give him most of the staff work to do within the flight, although obviously I had sort of take part in quite a lot of that myself. But I used to align myself more to the tactical role in being able to go up to divisional headquarters, advise the G1 or occasionally advising the GOC himself on what I knew about the front and give him my account of what I felt was going on in particular areas, and would act very much as the G member of the flight. And my sort of second command really became the sort of the AQ member of the flight. But my balance of duties, I suppose, was about two-thirds on the tactical side, including the flying, and the other side really doing the administration and going up to divisional headquarters. And in the case of my second in command, it was almost the reverse. So two-thirds of his time was taken up with administration and about one-third of flying VIPs, but also occasionally would do the reconnaissance role as well.
Was the administration done by paperwork, or was